From Albany, New York, this is Public Health Radio.
On today's program, we interview Dr. Joanna Santabarbara on the topic of war and public health.
War is a massive public health disaster.
A child psychiatrist, Dr. Santabarbara is professor at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, where she teaches in the Center for Peace Studies. I'm Elaine Hills, PhD candidate in epidemiology at the University at Albany School of Public Health, here with my co-host, Dr. Andrew Coates, practicing physician. We return with our interview with Dr. Joanna Santabarbara after some news from the world of public health.
The Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations reports that almost no progress has been made in the fight against global hunger in recent years. In 1996, the World Food Summit set the historic goal of reducing by half the number of hungry people in the developing world by 2015. 10 years after this goal was set, the report concludes, quote, "We have been standing still in terms of hunger reduction." The report estimates that the overall number of undernourished people in the developing world declined by 26 million in the 1990s, but rose again by 23 million since the turn of the new century. The report by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations amounts to a failing report card for the world's hunger reduction efforts. The report notes that, quote, "peace and stability are the sine qua non for hunger reduction." In October 2006, a federal jury in Chicago found a health maintenance organization guilty of discriminating against pregnant women and other patients at risk for needing hospitalization. The HMO, Amerigroup, provided managed Medicaid services to Illinois residents from 2000 to 2003. The state of Illinois paid the insurance company $243 million in Medicaid money. The jury found that Amerigroup sought to intentionally avoid enrolling sick patients when it promised the state of Illinois that it would enroll Medicaid recipients without regard to their health status. According to the October 31st Chicago Tribune, quote, "a series of emails and statements from Amerigroup executives were key elements in the plaintiff's case. A 2001 email by Illinois Director of Medical Management said, quote, please keep up the good work with the marketing reps of not trying to sign up pregnant women. In another email, the executive said the company had continued to build experience in not signing up pregnant women or people from areas where drug abuse was prevalent. Another Amerigroup executive said in a sworn statement that it was always his policy to, quote, go after the healthies. Amerigroup was ordered to pay damages of $144 million, although the company plans to appeal. Amerigroup is expected to have $3 billion in revenue this year. A study published in the November 3 issue of the journal Science reports that all species of wild seafood currently fished are projected to collapse or be reduced by 90% by the year 2050. The four-year study, conducted by an international team of ecologists and economists, warns that this loss of biodiversity will profoundly reduce the ocean's ability to produce seafood, resist diseases, filter pollutants, and adapt to stresses such as overfishing and climate change. The comprehensive study examined all existing data on ocean species and ecosystems by synthesizing historical, experimental, fishery, and observational data. The authors report that the same consistent effect was predictable whether the entire world's oceans were examined or whether specific tide pools were the subject of focus. Some hope the study will serve as a wake-up call to change human practices that detrimentally impact global fisheries, noting that if we act now, it is not too late to turn these trends around. In many cases, species lost can be recovered in a matter of 3 to 10 years if they have not passed the point of no return. Study co-author Steve Palumbi of Stanford University said, quote, "unless we fundamentally change the way we manage all the ocean species together as working ecosystems, then this century is the last century of wild seafood." Finally, we urge listeners to look up the Human Development Report of 2006, entitled Beyond Scarcity, Power, Poverty, and the Global Water Crisis. The report looks at ending the crisis in water and sanitation, where today 1.2 billion people lack access to safe water and 2.6 billion people lack access to sanitation. The report estimates that it would cost $10 billion a year to reduce by half the percentage of people without access to safe drinking water and to provide them with simple pit latrines. The New York Times pointed out that this is less than half of what rich countries spend annually on bottled water. The authors of the report write, "Toilets may be an unlikely catalyst for human progress, but the evidence that they are is overwhelming. Adequate sanitation has the potential to produce cumulative benefits in public health, employment, and economic growth. So why is it, at the start of the 21st century, so much human potential is being wasted for want of some fairly simple technologies? And why does sanitation lag so far behind water in public provision? These questions are as germane to debates on human development today as they were in developed countries more than a century ago." To read the report, please visit hdr.undp.org. That's hdr.undp.org, the United Nations Development Program 2006 Human Development Report.
Dr. Joanna Santa Barbara is a child psychiatrist who teaches in the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. There, Dr. Santa Barbara has helped develop an academic discipline called Peace Through Health, in which scholars study how health interventions in actual and potential war zones may contribute to peace. Peace Through Health initiatives have taken many forms: humanitarian ceasefire, the use of health expertise to restrict weapons and war strategies, and efforts to combine individual and social healing in war zones. Through Peace Through Health efforts, Dr. Santa Barbara has participated in field projects in Croatia, Gaza, Sri Lanka, and Afghanistan. Her work in Afghanistan began prior to the 2001 American invasion and is ongoing. In the second half of our interview, she speaks about her work in Afghanistan. Dr. Santa Barbara is also a leader of Physicians for Global Survival, the Canadian affiliate of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. In 1985, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for its work to educate health professionals, political leaders, and the public about the medical consequences of nuclear war. Near the start of our interview, you will hear Dr. Santa Barbara modestly refer to years of activism she has dedicated on behalf of this prestigious and important organization. Dr. Santa Barbara, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you very much, Elaine.
Dr. Santa Barbara, tell us how you came to teach at the Center for Peace Studies.
I was a practicing child psychiatrist and also teaching clinical skills in my faculty. And for a long time, for about as long as I can remember, I'd been concerned about issues of war and peace, and in particular, issues of nuclear war. When I found that there was a physicians' organization dealing with the issue of nuclear war, or at least I discovered that there was one in the U.S., I then joined others in setting about establishing such an organization in Canada and have belonged to it and worked for it ever since. But from there, having dipped my toe into activist work in the area of war and peace, I found myself going ankle deep and knee deep, because at the same time at my university there was a cluster of scholars across disciplines intent on finding a way to teach peace in the university, and I soon found myself part of that cluster and representing the Faculty of Health Sciences in that cluster. And within a short time, I found myself teaching Introduction to Peace Studies and then adding on some of the other subject areas that I teach in. And in recent years, in the last couple of years, it's become my predominant activity, as it's enormously gratifying and seems tremendously important.
Dr. Santa Barbara, how did the Peace Through Health program develop?
In the early 90s, a number of us from both Faculty of Health Sciences at my university, McMaster, and a number of people who were working in the Center for Peace Studies got together because there had been the 91 war against Iraq, followed closely by eruption of the sequence of wars in the Balkans. And we got together in some distress, really saying, what can we do, and is there anything we can do together as peace scholars and health scholars? Is there any way we can act together to somehow try to make things less terrible? Out of that gradually evolved what we came to call Peace Through Health. We began to work on a number of projects in various war zones in Gaza, Croatia, Sri Lanka, and later Afghanistan. We evolved a way of working and a way of thinking about our work that had to do with understanding and addressing health needs in a situation, and also gaining an understanding of the conflict dynamic and the violence that was proceeding in the situation to try to have an impact on both areas. Logically, this goes together, because if you're trying to heal people and there's either ongoing violence or a high risk of recurrence of violence, it certainly makes sense to try to stop more people getting hurt. So we approach this in a variety of ways in different projects, but this combination of mental health and peace building was one way that we wove these two things together. At the same time, we also stepped back and tried to look at the literature about who has done this before, who has looked at health impact of war and attempted to do health interventions in a way that built peace. And we found that WHO, or particularly PAHO, the Pan American Health Organization, had this very interesting history of noticing that in war situations, and at that time it was Central American war situations, vaccination rates go down. And in the particular situation in which they began, El Salvador, they were able to say that more children were dying through lack of vaccination than were dying from direct violence of the war. And what came of that was the humanitarian ceasefire, which was used in El Salvador, and which is generally considered to have contributed to the eventual peace accord by showing people that they could stop shooting at each other for the well-being of their children. They could negotiate a temporary ceasefire for the benefit of their children, so they could also negotiate a permanent ceasefire, which they did. Humanitarian ceasefires have been used in other parts of the world, or many other parts of the world, in fact, as a health intervention, potentially contributing to the working out of peace. So we looked at the variety of ways in which work from the health sector has contributed to peace, and we tried to systematize that to develop a typology of ways that you can work from the health sector to further peace. And out of that developed our theory and our development of practice in Peace Through Health.
I understand you're now teaching the Peace Through Health program to undergraduate students.
So now we have enough of a body of knowledge, having run a couple of international conferences on the topic, to teach an undergrad course in Peace Through Health. Taught under peace studies, but it draws students from many faculties. And lots of students who will enter medicine subsequently also do it before they enter medicine. So we find now that we have the cadre of medical students who are oriented to macro determinants of health to the global health issues, and who are extremely eager to become educated in these global health issues. So this little cluster of us, we've been able to link with other similar clusters across the world who are doing similar work in a framework that has different names in different places. But it feels like a growing movement. What I'm currently working on day by day is a textbook on peace through health to use in such courses, and also to help health professionals just grasp a framework of action for working from the health sector for peace.
Would you say that the Peace Through Health course that you teach, and perhaps also the textbook you're working on, focus to any larger extent on primary versus secondary versus tertiary prevention, or is there an equal focus on these modes of prevention?
There are Peace Through Health activities, projects, programs that people do in all of those modalities, primary, secondary, and tertiary. My own interest is heavily on the primary. Some of the tertiary interventions that I've been involved with, I also conceive as primary. What I mean specifically is the peace education to both children and adults in the post-violent conflict or peace-building phase of a former war zone is, I think, an important way of looking at that is primary prevention, attempting to lessen the probability of a further outbreak of political violence. Because we've come to know that in immediate post-violent conflict phases, there's a high probability within the next half decade of resumption of political violence if the peace-building processes are not well accomplished. So we hope to basically sort of expand peace literacy, the understanding that people have of, say, the importance of investing in reconciliation processes. But part of that would also be the importance of investing in health. It's actually a datum derived from World Bank studies of war that a country in a post-violent conflict phase that invests in health will thereby lessen their probability of moving back into violent conflict subsequently. It's as if the government was sending a message that we care about the population. We're investing in people's well-being rather than in armament.
Recently, The Lancet reported that 655,000 excess deaths have occurred in Iraq as a result of the war and occupation that began there in 2003 and continues to this day. Can you comment on that for our listeners?
Well, it was a stunning study. Its political importance was demonstrated, I think, by the resistance to the findings of this study. Those in whose interest that war continues found furious reasons to attack the study, which I think lets us know that it found its mark. It reached its target to get across the knowledge that the losses incurred in this war, if we just think of mortality, quite apart from injury, psychological suffering, etc., mortality alone, the losses are horrendous, pointing out that political goals couldn't possibly be sought to justify losses at this level. I think we can only deal with this idea without outrage by denying the significance of death of others who are far away and different from us. I think that it had that significance, but I think that looking at what this study exemplifies is the role of the health sector in exposing this kind of knowledge, in showing us what war does and what war is, that war is a massive public health disaster. I think that a study by the health sector carries moral or value significance, because for health sector workers, avoidable deaths are significant. They're not just numbers. Every life counts to health professionals, and every life counts equally to health professionals. And 655,000 excess deaths is a horrendous human catastrophe. I think the study was very significant, and how significant it was has been marked by its rocky reception.
Dr. Santa Barbara, it strikes me that the health effects of war are extensive. We often think of war in terms of mortality, how many people are killed as a result of war. The range of health effects that are seen as a result of war are something that we don't often consider. Can you perhaps give our listeners a sense of the extent of suffering that is caused by war?
You're quite right in pointing out that mortality is only the starkest indicator of what war does to people who are caught in it. My focus has been particularly on children, but I'm always being reminded that children are just part of the population, and that old people suffer too, and women suffer most terribly in war, and men suffer. But because my clinical life has been with children, I've focused on children, and children and others are injured in war, often terrible injuries involving loss of limbs or sight or hearing or involving facial disfigurement. And many such injuries involve long-term disabilities, obviously. Most war zones don't have good facilities for rehabilitation of disabilities. For example, some of the landmine statistics appear to show that a child can wait for 10 years before, in some arenas of war, before getting a prosthesis. And because children are growing, the prostheses they get rarely keep up with the growth of their limbs. Children suffer psychologically very severely because they're exposed to a horrible sequence of events, often involving atrocious behavior by others. And some of the aftermath of that can be traced in post-traumatic stress disorder and anxiety and depression. Some of the studies of children in war zones make clear that they suffer these clinical states at much higher levels than children in ordinary circumstances. And, of course, largely with no intervention whatsoever. And very frequently with parents who are also depressed and much less functional as parents, that is, indeed, if they are actually there, than usual. So those are some of the ranges of things. If we think of individual kids or individual families, but thinking also at a public health level, health infrastructure gets damaged or destroyed in war, and that's certainly been a feature of the Iraq War. There's evidence that the destruction of Baghdad water treatment facilities was in fact deliberate. In the 2003 attack, it was certainly deliberate during sanctions to disallow the repair of water treatment facilities. And anyone with the merest public health knowledge will be aware of the epidemic illness aftermath of untreated water in large urban conglomerations of people. So the health effects of war go way beyond those who are actually killed. In fact, death from other causes of mortality like epidemic illness and malnutrition and starvation in many war zones are higher than death from the direct violence of shooting or bombing.
One way of thinking about how war impacts humans is by looking at what effect war has on human security. We've talked a bit about the effect of war on health security. And war also has a great impact on other domains of security, economic security, food security, environmental security. These are all impacts of war that many of us who haven't lived in war zones don't have a sense for, since we haven't lived through those experiences. Can you tell us a bit about what that is like for people who are living in war zones?
Imagine a family living under war conditions where people may not be able to actually get out to get supplies for their family, that they simply have inadequate food to feed children, inadequate access to medical treatment for sick or injured children. And we also have to imagine simply living in fear of the direct violence that comes with war, fear of deprivation, fear of not being able to provide for each other in a family, and fear of staying together. People get separated in war. People get displaced in war and have to flee to camps either within their borders or outside their borders. Families get separated. Unaccompanied children are highly vulnerable. And when you develop that picture of what a war involves, you then have to look at kids and young women being vulnerable to sexual predation, to rape as an instrument of war, and also to abduction and trafficking. A whole host of awful sequelae follow the unfolding events of war. All of course, affecting health of individuals.
Many news reports about war tell us about refugees, people who are displaced as a result of war. Can you tell us about this?
There are many millions of such people in the world, and this is not a transient state. Not long ago, I met a teenager from a Palestinian refugee camp in Lebanon. He was a brilliantly intelligent guy, but he was just bristling with frustration because there was nothing to do with his energy and intelligence. He couldn't leave the camp. He couldn't train in any profession or vocation. He had to sit there, and he had to sit there for into the interminable future. He couldn't see any possible end to what was happening in his life. He was a wonderful guy, but angry, frustrated, and couldn't see any reason for hope.
You've been listening to Dr. Joanna Santa Barbara, who teaches in the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster University. Our interview continues after a short break. Please stay tuned to Public Health Radio. Welcome back to Public Health Radio. Today, Elaine and I interviewed Dr. Joanna Santa Barbara, who spoke to us on November 10th, 2006, from her home in Hamilton, Ontario. In the first half of our interview, Dr. Santa Barbara told us how she came to teach in the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster University, and how profoundly war and public health intersect. Dr. Santa Barbara is a child psychiatrist and longtime physician activist in the struggle against nuclear weapons. She is a founding member of Physicians for Global Survival, the Canadian affiliate of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. In the second half of our interview, we pursue an in-depth discussion of Dr. Santa Barbara's Peace Through Health work in Afghanistan. We learn that Peace Through Health is both an academic discipline and a strategy for public health intervention. Peace Through Health seeks to aid both individuals and whole societies. It seeks to halt and prevent war, and we learn in our interview how mental health work for children can lead to dialogue with government leaders. Dr. Santa Barbara, to begin our discussion of Afghanistan, would you please describe what happened in the most recent war there?
What happened was that there was a civil war proceeding, and to put it in its simplest terms, it was the Taliban on one side against another cluster of political and ethnic factions on the other side called the Northern Alliance. And at the point when the US-UK invaded, the Taliban had for some time had control of Kabul and a large portion of the country. Both or all of the factions prior to that had committed ghastly atrocities on each other. It certainly wasn't a matter of one side good and the other side bad. In fact, when the Taliban took power of the Northern Alliance areas, many people were relieved because they were harsh law and order people, and people needed law and order at that time. So then the US-UK invaded because of the Taliban's refusal to surrender Osama bin Laden, although many observers felt that there was much further that negotiations could proceed before reaching such a conclusion. The US-UK basically sided with the Northern Alliance to push the Taliban out of Kabul and way into the mountain fastnesses, proceeded to the Bonn Agreement, which would lead to an elected president, elected parliament, a new constitution. The Northern Alliance then moved into Kabul and, to a fair extent, controlled the emerging government, excluding Taliban participation. So the Taliban, having been excluded from governance processes, did what all such groups do under such circumstances: they took to arms in order to be heard. And over the last several years, the strength of that insurgency has steadily grown until it appears now that the Taliban at least partially occupy pretty much the southern half of Afghanistan and are recruiting members rapidly.
During this period of time, how would you characterize the social and health conditions in Afghanistan? And how do Afghans feel about what's been happening in their country?
First of all, we start with the background that Afghanistan has been one of the poorest countries in the world in terms of health, mortality figures, infant mortality, maternal mortality, nutritional levels, education levels. Afghanistan is near rock bottom poor. In terms of human rights indicators affecting women, that plunged over the period of the so-called Mujahideen Wars and the Taliban regime. Women suffered extremely badly over all of that time, not just with the Taliban regime, prior to and including that regime. The complaints of village-level people now, 5 years after the invasion and after millions of dollars have been poured in to help Afghan people, the people at the village level say they're no better off. And I know that doesn't mean that no development has taken place. Some development has taken place. But they're very serious discontent, particularly of rural people, that their lives are no better. And they blame two sources. They blame their government for corruption and general ineptness, and they blame foreign forces. And they're getting more and more discontent, which, of course, means that the Taliban have a more fertile field to move into. So lives, in general, are scarcely better off now than they were.
Would you please tell us about your work in Afghanistan and take us through step by step?
Our work in Afghanistan began before the 2001 invasion, and it began in this framework of working for peace through health, with the idea of exploring with Afghans whether they would feel in need of or welcome an intervention which was designed to help with the mental health impact of war. And the answer was yes. In fact, the answer was please, and do it soon. We also combined that with elements of not just individual healing, but also social healing. So the idea of helping people with their anger, depression, anxiety, confusion, stress, etc., resulting from their war experience, but combining that, looking at the possibilities for reconciliation across ethnic divides, dealing with conflict nonviolently, with even the idea of using nonviolent struggle instead of violence when struggles have to be carried on. We produced a sort of package in which we included all of those elements and directed it to some groups of adults, and we began with some very brave groups of Afghans who were basically themselves peace education non-governmental organizations. And all non-governmental organizations under the Taliban regime had to flee from their bases in Kabul into Pakistan and were based in Peshawar, just over the border. So these groups who were based in Peshawar would cross over the border, negotiate with local Taliban commanders, and then deliver peace education to Afghan schools, which was a really interesting and really courageous thing for them to be doing. Well, they were our original partners, and they were the people that we originally worked on this mental health plus peace education intervention with. Out of that, we developed a program, a school-based program for children, which included all of those elements of mental health and peace education, but they were delivered in the form of stories that were part of a family saga. And these stories were animated by puppets, which dozens of women in Canada and Australia produced for use in Afghan schools. That material was later adopted by the Ministry of Education in Afghanistan and propagated to many, many more children. An interesting thing then happened, which in some ways transformed aspects of the project that we were doing. The people that were our initial partners with whom we held workshops on these issues kept saying, this is very good, it's very helpful to us, but it should be heard by others. It should be heard by people who are decision makers. They're the people who need to understand alternatives to violence and the peace education part of this. The next thing that happened was that a university in exile called the Afghan University in Peshawar organized a large workshop with politicians across the spectrum invited, including Taliban. And we had asked for as many women as possible to be included. And we then ran a series of workshops on this material, which the Afghan decision makers got stuck into in a big way, generating ideas for dealing with the conflicts of Afghanistan in a nonviolent way. The next thing that happened was the US-UK invasion of Afghanistan with the unseating of the Taliban regime and the development of a new government, in which case the NGOs and our work, too, moved to Kabul and continued out of Kabul. With more workshops for decision-makers, politicians, media people, academics, then a request to formalize this in training Afghan peace educators, which we did. We developed manuals to do that. In fact, they wanted us to establish peace studies in Afghan universities, which is a goal to which we never had quite reached at this time. A couple of people who are trained as peace educators are now actually ministers in the cabinet of Afghanistan. And the emphasis over the last couple of years has been on reconciliation, because Afghanistan, it was clear to us, continued to be severely split into quite hostile ethnic groups who often couldn't work together when they were put together in ministries of education and so on. So that the need for reconciliation processes seemed to us to be extremely great. So that's been an emphasis of our work in recent years. But just now our work is directed to a plan to try to actually stop the war. We strongly believe that there's the potential for peace dialogue with the Taliban and associated groups to reach a negotiated end of this war rather than continue fighting what many commentators say is an unwinnable, militarily unwinnable war in Afghanistan. Some of our team members have actually met high-ranking Taliban leaders to probe this possibility, to find out, could we sit down and have peace dialogues to bring an end to this war? And the answer has been yes. They were really interested. They brought lists of talking points to the table to try to work towards a negotiated end. Now, we've been operating at that level, which is purely political or diplomatic level, at the same time as continuing to operate at the grassroots level in a health capacity, a mental health capacity in the schools. The schools project keeps going and, in fact, has expanded. But at the same time, with the opportunity arising to provide our insights, our positions derived from peace process knowledge to the political situation, we have taken that opportunity. We grabbed it. And that's where we are at the moment. And that's just at the moment, while I still work on the health project, more of my energies are absorbed into the attempt to actually end the war.
Dr. Santa Barbara, I've been shocked to learn about the use of cluster bombs in Afghanistan, not only during the initial American bombing and invasion, but the ongoing use of cluster bombs. Would you comment?
Yeah, I have found that very shocking, that NATO, it seems, is using cluster bombs. Now, cluster bombs, which were also used by Israel on Lebanon in June, are, strictly speaking, legal. They're not outlawed by international treaty as landmines were or are. But there's a big effort throughout the world involving the International Committee of the Red Cross, the landmines organizations, and others to outlaw cluster bombs because they have very similar effects to those of landmines in that a proportion of them don't explode, and that proportion apparently, depending on the make of the cluster bomb, can be 5% to 30% of the bomblets that are in that cluster bomb. The idea of a cluster bomb is that it's a warhead that explodes and distributes indiscriminately across an area bomblets that then explode on contact. Anyway, some of them don't explode, so they lie there and then explode when a child picks them up or when a farmer is tilling a field or when a woman collecting firewood disturbs them. So they're weapons of indiscriminate destruction, and they're weapons that kill civilians, and they're weapons that can lie around for years and affect innocent people later, and they're weapons that can make areas uninhabitable so that people can't even go back and salvage their belongings from destroyed homes, and farmers can't till their fields or gather their harvest if it's known that there are cluster bombs there. So they have all the bad and fundamentally not only immoral but illegal aspects that led to the outlawing of landmines. And quite recently, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has made a strong, clear statement urging that cluster bombs be outlawed. So it's very upsetting that NATO countries are using them in Afghanistan.
I'm thinking about the courage of people that do the health work that you're describing. In my professional life, as you know, one of the things I do is to care for the dying, and I'm familiar with the enormous grief and stress that surrounds the death of a loved one, even in the best of circumstances.
Yeah, I think it is courageous. What we encountered was people who would be dealing with their own losses and their own enormous difficulties in just living day by day and helping their families survive, but who yet somehow summoned the energy to work for others, to work for the sake of others and for the sake of their people. One really interesting guy that we encountered had a young man who'd had some of his education in the UK and was known to us before we arrived because we had read some of the papers he'd produced and had very great respect for him. And I found as I traveled with him to a meeting that he had lost a leg in some of the fighting during the Mujahideen Wars, yet was distinctly in factional fighting in Kabul. But as he described that and as I explored where he was with that, he also described being substantially helped by other members of the same ethnic faction that had attacked him, and helped by people who were risking their lives and safety in order to assist him. Oh, he was also a deeply religious guy, I recall, as I talked to him about his application of Islam to his conviction of working for the good of others. He is now the Minister of Education.
So you've had dialogue with political leaders in Afghanistan. What do you find in your dialogue with political leaders in Canada?
What we do encounter, not from all political parties, but from the one in power, which is the Conservative Party, very simplistic ideas, sort of Taliban bad, former Northern Alliance good, we were going to get the bad guys, we're going to exterminate the bad guys, and this is what Afghans want. Well, survey after survey is emerging that this is not what Afghans want. So it, at the moment it's quite difficult to convince the party in power of a more complex appreciation of what's actually happening in Afghanistan. But it's not so difficult to convince Canadians of this. Canadians' public opinion is swinging more and more in a direction favorable to the sort of policy ideas that we're recommending.
Where can our listeners find more information about the policies you're recommending, as well as your work in Afghanistan?
I can give you a website which has both material on the intervention, the peace through health interventions we devise, and also up-to-date material on our policy recommendations for the war in Afghanistan. So I'll spell it out carefully for listeners who hopefully can pick up a pencil to take it down. It's www.humanities.mcmaster, that's M-C-M-A-S-T-E-R, .ca/peace-health. I'll say that again, www.humanities.mcmaster.ca/peace-health.
Now I'd like to change topics slightly, if I might, and ask you to please talk about the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War.
Gladly. And I'll frame that by saying that this is yet another way that people in the health sector work for peace. And it's an organization that is a splendid example of redefining war peace issues as public health issues. So in this case, the issue that was redefined was the issue of nuclear weapons, which the physicians who founded this organization refused to consider merely from a military framework or a political framework. Although they were frequently told that was the only framework from which to look at this phenomenon, they insisted that this was a health issue. And they wrote on it as a health issue. They published in the early 80s a now famous paper in the New England Journal of Medicine detailing the health effects of nuclear weapons. And on that foundation, the work of the organization grew and spread to dozens of countries throughout the world.
So the name of that organization says a lot, the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. But perhaps you could talk more broadly about prevention. Primary, secondary, tertiary prevention.
The public health model of primary prevention, where you attempt to act on the antecedent causes so that the pathological events don't unfold, and secondary prevention, where you act on a war that's happening to try in various ways to mitigate the harmful impact on people and to bring it to an end as soon as possible. And then the idea of tertiary prevention, where you pick up the pieces, you patch people up, you rehabilitate people. These are extremely useful thinking structures for war, and I think genuinely help people to, including people who are in the middle of war or in situations of imminent war, to think clearly about what sort of problem solving they're trying to do. So health and peace and war and disease have a lot in common and indeed can be useful metaphors for each other.
Dr. Santa Barbara, would you please give us some closing thoughts on public health workers and war?
War is way up there among global causes of mortality, morbidity, and general human suffering. And it's a preventable cause. We know ways of preventing war, and we do. When we use those ways, we do actually prevent wars. So the health sector, in looking at war or political violence as a major cause of ill health, and the potential of the health sector in acting on that cause of ill health, yeah, I think that there is an imperative there for us to use the capacities that we have.
It's been a pleasure interviewing you, Dr. Santa Barbara. Thank you and good night.
Good night to both of you.
Thank you for joining us for Public Health Radio. If you've missed any part of today's broadcast or would like to hear any of our previous broadcasts, you can find us online at www.publichealthradio.org. That's all one word, publichealthradio.org.